Michael Meets is a podcast interviewing regular people about life, work, their interests, and aspirations. Coming up in this podcast, Glenn McGuinness talks about the things that have shaped his life, from coming out to his school friends in first year, about being bullied in secondary school, the impact of his mother's addictions on family life, and how nature has a greater influence on you being you. He also talks about being a drag queen, the up-and-coming marriage equality referendum, and his hopes for the future. The year was 1993, the year that Albert Reynolds was elected Taoiseach of Ireland, the year that Mother Teresa met the President of Ireland, Mary Robinson. It was also the year that the Queen of England spoke of her hopes for peace in Northern Ireland in her Christmas Day message. On the other side of the Atlantic, Bill Clinton became the 42nd President of the United States, the same year that Niamh Kavanagh won the Eurovision Song Contest for Ireland with In Your Eyes, giving Ireland its second of three consecutive wins. It was also the year that Ireland decriminalised homosexuality, and the year that Glenn McGuinness was born in the city of Dublin.
I was told one story, one repeated story amongst my family about the day I was born. And it was pretty much that I slid out. My family are very graphic when it comes to, you know, that type of situation. So it was, my brother was like a hefty load basically, and it was really hard. My mother's first child, and he was huge, and then like they had to help her get him out. And then me, she thought she was going to go to the toilet, and she was like, "Nurse, I need to go to the bathroom." She went to stand up, and the nurse was like, "No, don't move.
Yeah,
he's coming out." Well, it wasn't he at that time, it was it.
Glenn describes himself as a bit of an oddball that didn't always fit in. Here's one of his earliest memories from school.
When I was in junior events, they were called into the school because I was in trouble. And when they asked what I'd done, they were told that I was found in the yard during the, like, playtime, sitting on another boy's chest. And I was like, sitting on another boy's chest, that sounds like me. And then I was punching him in the face. I was like, that doesn't really sound like me, because I wouldn't fight people, that's not me. So it was a bit odd of a story. And then she asked me why, and the teacher had asked me why as well. So my aunt asked me why I was after doing what I did, and I said because he'd called my friend a black bitch. And it was me beating up another child for being racist before I knew anything about being different. So I think I was just a bit odd my whole life. I was always that kind of oddball that didn't fit in, and I tend to attract people who didn't fit in and kind of go through life with the odd group of people. So primary school was in St. Bridget's school, and just a whole new school there now, it's amazing. And in that school, it was then, when I was in junior infants and senior infants, even first class, and maybe the first few class years, it would have been odd to see a black person in the year. So that was odd then, and I've been back to Bridget since, because my cousins go there and they have every single race in perfect harmony of everybody in the skills now, and it's crazy to see that because of that situation back when I was younger. So primary school, I went through quite odd. I went through Bridget's, being the boy who played with the girls.
Glenn moved to an all-boys school in Francis Street, and it was in that school that he became friends with three other boys, all of whom later came out as gay. However, it was in St. James's Secondary School that they all come out to each other.
At the end of first year of secondary school, me and Jason came out to each other. And then it was during second year, Patrick came out to us then, and we came out to him, that type of way. And then Ryan never really came out to us because, I don't know, it was just, I think there was a bit of a block with Ryan. He didn't really, I think there was a bit of internal homophobia, or maybe he just didn't want it to be that way. And when he got older, he eventually did come out. He had a boyfriend. I remember seeing him one time in War. Like, it wasn't a gay night, but it was a gay night. There was only gay people in War, so it was a gay night. It was run by gay people, so it became a gay night. I remember seeing him there once with his boyfriend and just being like, when did this happen? I miss this, because I kind of fell out of touch with Ryan after I'd left the school, but Jason and Patrick would have still went to belong to and stuff like that, so we would have still spoke to each other. But it was just one of those weird experiences that, oh, I knew that was coming. I could see that in the waterworks.
You said you came out to yourself in sixth class.
Give or take.
What was that like? What happened?
Oh, it was kind of cringy. I'm not going to go into the dirty details, but I am. I can remember my older brother, hopefully he won't. Well, he probably will hear this because my aunt will probably promote people listening to this. He would be looking at, you know, dirty sites, because he was older than me, 3 years older, so he'd be like 13 at the time. So he was maybe 14, was one of those ages. I can't really remember ages when it comes to years of skill.
Yeah.
He would have been about that age, so like puberty hit him, and then he was looking at those type of sites, and I'd see them because your little brother, like, you're going to do the whole, oh, look at this. And it was kind of all right. You know, you see it and you're like, oh, look, that's a vagina. And you give it that weird look and you're like, yeah, it's nice. But I then see men just in magazines walking down the street, and even today I still do the same thing. The whole, you see them, you see their bodies through their shirts, or you see them topless and you're just like, well, yeah, I'd like some of that. And I kind of had them moments. The problem with me was I'm not only into men. I don't give a fuck about what people have downstairs or what they have upstairs or what they have anywhere. Well, actually, upstairs, in the head, yes. A whole personality vibe. So I'm not really bothered by gender. So in sixth class, well, that age about, I had the problem that I liked both. And I didn't understand why. And I'd already understood that I wasn't supposed to like men, so I didn't want to. But I knew I didn't only like women. So I had a lot of internal conflict with, why do I like this? Why don't I like this? And I eventually just went, oh, fuck it. It is what it is. I am what I am. I can't really change it now. So I just went with the flow, and just that's where it took me, and then came out to Jason in first year, and it kind of lifted that weight of, oh, okay, this is who I am now. Like, I don't have to think about it anymore. Is it, oh, what if other people don't think this way? And then I just didn't really care, and I didn't really know how other people thought, so I didn't know that I was thinking wrong at the time. So it was weird, but it just happened. I went to James Street. It was kind of that whole first year was that one fear of, do you know, these first year bashings that you hear about where like first years come into the skill and they get picked on for being first years. But again, I had an older brother in the skill, which seemed to be part of the group of boys. The boys. The ones that everybody thought were cool. So somehow he managed to get in there. I don't know how. I think it was football or something like that. He was sporty. So that didn't happen to me. But another thing I was terrified of going into skill was not being gay, because that was something that was always kind of in the back of my head. And it was in like sixth class that I came out to myself. So I was pretty young when I came out to myself. So that wasn't really troubling me going into first year, because I didn't understand that people wouldn't like it, because I didn't get that. It just didn't click in my head. But I was really frightened of being stupid, because I had a problem with reading throughout primary school. I was really bad at reading, simple as, and they thought I was dyslexic and stuff like that, but really I just wasn't very good at reading. I was afraid to read out loud, which would make me nervous, and then I couldn't read out loud, and it seemed like I was really bad at reading. And then I wasn't. It was just because it seemed like I was really bad at reading, they kept giving me extra reading classes and putting me down into a certain reading level that I probably wouldn't have been at if I was just encouraged more, but it was just me. I was very bad with confidence, and so my reading level wasn't that great, so I was really worried I was going to be stupid. But then I got put into like the high smart class, and I don't know how I got there. So after being in there with all of my friends, because we all ended up in the same class, so it was great, there was still not every other fella in the year or anything like that, because the fellas that we went to school with, most of them wouldn't have been homophobic because they know us, so they wouldn't be rude to us. So it's kind of how it was. There was a few in primary school, as you get, bullies, but that's just because I was weird. But in James Street, it was kind of, I didn't get any physical harassment other than like bumping into you in the corridor type thing, but everybody bumped into everybody. The whole system was terrible. But it was more verbal, like things people would say to you and the way they'd say them to you, and just horrible remarks about things that you were. And they had no right to have an opinion on it, but still they chose to have an opinion on it. And every gay person throughout the years of the school got picked on. And even talking to different gay people from different years, like we were talking to one from, I think he was 2 years older than us, and people used to pick on him all the time for being gay. And then one day he turned around and just goes, yeah, what? And then they stopped picking on him because he was gay then. And it was, well, we can't pick on him for being gay because now we know he is gay. We can't be like, oh, faggot. And him being like, yes, faggot. So that kind of ruined it for them, for him. But I don't think I was ready to do that yet. I don't think, especially with my brother being in the school and I wasn't out to my brother and that kind of thing. And then it got to third year of school and still always going to be the sly comments, the people saying stuff to me, people starting on me and saying things like they'll kick me and my brother's heads in. And I was like, no, you won't. His friends are the umphas in the school that hit you people for looking at them funny. But yeah, it was just horrible, and it began to just make going to school hard. So during third year, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I'm going to anyway, because sure, they can't give out to me now. I didn't really go to school that often. I'd go in late every day. I'd go in by little break, and then I'd just leave at lunch and not go back. And on Wednesdays, sometimes I just didn't bother to go in, and other days I just wouldn't go in because I got so fed up with people constantly saying stuff to me and thinking they could get away with it. And they were getting away with it because I wasn't telling anybody about it, and I wasn't really picking up for myself that much. Well, I'd try, but if I was on my own, I wouldn't, because I remembered at the end of the day, I'd walk home on my own because my brother would be with his friends, or we'd be off at different times because he was in sixth year at the time. So I just didn't bother. I used to get detention all the time for being late because I'd go in at little break and I'd be like, what are you going to do? The principal used to, I used to come in at the same time every day, like halfway through the third class, give or take, and the vice principal got into the habit of waiting for me at the door, accompanying me to my locker, talking to me about why, not even why I was late, just talking to me because he knew I was going to be late. I don't know whether he was doing it on purpose or it was just he happened to walk past at that time of the day, but I just didn't bother. And then again, the end of that year, I realised my brother wouldn't be in the school the next year. He was doing his leaving cert, I was doing my junior, and if I was to come back to the school, I wouldn't have that protection anymore, because I always did, because the comments would be always, I'll kill you and your brother, because they thought, oh, if I insult him, his brother's going to say something, but we can't, we can threaten that, but nothing's ever going to come out of it, because my brother was in sixth year and he was a big part of the sporty, rough group. Well, not rough, they were all nice. Still friends with most of them, they're really nice people. And that was kind of always there, so I always had that through primary school, through secondary school. So then when I got to third year, I realised that wasn't going to happen anymore. And I was frightened of that. And then the school wasn't brilliant for subject choices for the leaving cert, and I really wanted to do science. So I needed science, and they weren't planning on going on with doing, they had one science option, and they, two people or something had signed up for it, so they weren't really planning on doing it. So then I left for that reason as well. But it was, the bullying was hard to deal with. It was, you get fed up.
And do you ever see any of the bullies around today? Because you
still hang. I had a lovely bully from in third class of primary school. He was really aggressive, and his older brother was friends with my older brother, so there was no real, my older brother wouldn't pick up for me because the bully's brother was his friend, so he didn't want to get into like that kind of awkward situation. But I'll see him every now and again, because they all live in the area, so you bump into these people and you see them and you're just like, oh God, you're really nothing anymore, are you? It's just, that's kind of, some people I will see and I'm like, you're after turning out to be a really nice person, and they'll say hello to you and stuff, and it's like, this is really weird, you, the last time you'd say anything to me would be an insult or something like that. And obviously you're after growing up and maturing, and it's, so you wouldn't, if you do see the ones that never really grew out of it, they're not really doing anything with their lives, they're the same people, they're not going to go anywhere. And if you see ones that have grown up and copped on and they were only doing it because it was peer pressure or whatever like that, you're like, okay, they're okay now. It's like they were just following the crowd. I can't really, in a country where you're raised to be homophobic, it's hardly fair to judge people for being homophobic that young. So If they grew out of it, they grew out of it. So I don't really get bothered when I see them.
Okay. Who would you say to date is your greatest influence in life?
My greatest influence in life? Sounds like a really daunting task. I'd say the best person I've had for moral judgment would, well, influence, yeah, would be my aunt, Anne, and my grandmother for completely other reasons. But Anne would be very, she encouraged me to be the weirdo. She didn't encourage me to be the weirdo. She wasn't pushing me going, light that fire. Like, but she was the type that didn't, well, still is the type, that didn't force any of us to focus in on any certain type of way we should be. She just let us be who we were. So me and her used to go on walks when I was younger. I can't really remember all of them. I can remember what the walk would generally entail. We'd go to the credit union, she'd take me to the shop for sweets, and then we'd just talk, walking around the tenders. And she just let me talk. She let me be who I was. And she encouraged me in later life, then she encouraged me to do whatever I wanted, which is great. She still encourages me to do whatever I wanted. Sometimes she thinks she shouldn't have. But yeah, she would be my best influence for being me rather than following the peers or being a sheep. But not telling me to be a shepherd either. She's just telling me to be me, and I don't want to be a shepherd.
Like my own grandmother, whom I got the inspiration for this podcast, Glenn's grandmother had a great influence on him. I asked him to tell me a little more about her.
Annie. Oh, she was... she was just Annie. There was no real way to describe... She was... All she had was love. She just couldn't understand... Well, I presume she could understand why people could hate people, because I'm sure she could hate people, because she gave a look. A serious look. Now, when you were in trouble, you got that look, and then she hit you. But you more than likely got the look first. Whether you saw her or not, you got the look. But she just took care of people, and she was really good at taking care of people. But what she would have taught me was never to not give. I don't know how to word it, to be a very giving person. She'd give anybody anything, and she was a feeder. So if someone was hungry, she wouldn't let that last very long. And if someone was skinny, she wouldn't let that last very long. If someone needed anything, that's what she did. She's that kind of woman. I think it was because when she was younger, she wouldn't have had much. Like, not many people in this area had much at that age when they were, well, around that time. But she wouldn't have had much. She had a lot of siblings in one room, that type of family. So she liked to give what she had. It meant that she had nothing by the end of the day, but her saying was always, better off whole broke than half broke. So that's what I got from her, is the kind of caring for people and giving to people, which I probably don't do that much. Like, the story from when I was in junior infants and picked up for that girl, that part of me faded throughout life. And I think it was just fear. Once I started to get bullied, and then bullying kept on, and then homophobia kind of took over from then, I kind of lost that picking up for other people because I was already afraid to pick up for myself. But I'd still take care of other people where I could, because that's what she taught me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She took me in, so I should probably take other people in if I can. I was raised by my grandmother in her lovely house in Brown Street, which I now live in. I lived with her for a while whilst my mother was away getting detoxed or rehabilitation. I don't know the word. I can't think of the word. But then after that, we went back to live with my mother in a house that she got in Crumlin. And all three of us lived with her for a while. My brother left after a while because he was kind of older, and he was always with my grandmother. Like, I was 6 at the time that we moved back in with my mother. So he would have been about 9, and he was with me nanny for like a lot longer. I keep saying grandmother and it feels wrong. With me nanny for a lot longer. So he kind of felt comfortable there. So after about a year and a bit, he moved back down. He was like, that was his house. That was how he was, and it still is his house. So it's something that he couldn't leave. But then me and my sister lived with my mother for a while. And after a few years, her rehabilitation didn't take. It just didn't. It did take in a way, because instead of going straight back to hardcore drugs, she kind of gradually made her way there. So it wasn't just, you know, straight back in. So that gave us time. But then it wasn't the fact that she went back to drugs, because nobody really knew about that. But like, I didn't even know about it at the time, because I wouldn't have understood it to know about it. So that wouldn't have made me move back to my grandmother's. It was, she got this boyfriend and he was an evil prick, for lack of a better term. And he was kind of the reason that I eventually just didn't want to be there anymore. Her not being, you know, her not telling him to fuck off and like let us live was kind of part of it. But yeah, I moved back down with my nanny for the reason that I was closer to school. I was very smart. Taught this out. So that would have been, I think that was sixth class as well. Jesus, a lot happened in sixth class. I think it was around that year, I feel. I think so, because we went on holiday that year with my grandparents. So yeah, I think so. But Jodie lived there for a little bit longer, but my grandmother took all of us in eventually, because Jodie did move down. So she kept us with her, and I lived with her then for the rest of my life. Like, I lived with her till she died last year, so technically she wasn't living there, was she? So yeah, and I still live in the house at the moment. So she took us in, and just, it wasn't that she took us in and babied us and was like, oh, it'll be okay now. It just happened. It wasn't like she came up and took us back. I just slowly moved my stuff into her house. I don't know if she noticed, but it happened. And yeah, she just took care of us and raised us from then on in. Maybe fa. I blame her, because I can't blame myself.
Glenn, can you remember a defining moment that changed your relationship with your mother?
Oh, there was a horrible Christmas. No, it was after I moved down to my grandmother's. I still had a relationship with my mother, because it wasn't her that I had the problem with. And the drugs thing didn't really come back up, because I don't think, it didn't come up for like a year after, because again, I didn't realise what was happening. So there was no way I could tell. I couldn't rat on her because I didn't know what she was doing wrong. So that wasn't really, we still had a relationship with her. And then the Christmas after I moved down, I went back up for Christmas, because that's what I did. And the boyfriend was dying. I'm not going to say how happy I was, because that's evil. He was really sick with something to do with drugs. And he was in hospital when I went back up for Christmas. And then he came out like Christmas Eve by himself. And then that was probably the worst Christmas Eve in my life. Which is pretty easy to happen, because Christmas Eve is a happy time. So it wasn't that bad, really, when you think about it. But he was just, he was out of his face on either painkillers, the fact that his liver was slowly falling out of his arse, or drugs. Don't know. And my mother wasn't exactly sober either. So they had an argument, and then she fell asleep on the sofa. But then he decided he was going to make that Christmas hell for me and my sister. And it was just a really horrible experience. He locked us in the room. He was shouting at us. There was no like physical abuse or anything like that. It wasn't crazy like that. But it was just horrible and rude. And my little sister's Christmas was ruined, because I already knew Sandy was gone.
What?
Exactly. he came and gone, you know. He already came down that chimney. So she just, I felt more for her, but it was a horrible situation. And my mother ended up having to kick him out on Christmas Eve type thing. And we went back down to my nanny's the next day. Obviously Christmas, that's what we did. We all congregated in my nanny's house. But that would have been a point that was a bit, we're not too happy with you, Jenna. But still, the relationship kept on, because he died. So, well, he's dead. Tough. So we moved on from that, and she was still involved in our lives. And Jodie moved down to us then the year after. And that's kind of when, I think it was around that time that, I'm not very good with the timeline, because a lot of the memories I wouldn't really keep. So, there's probably a lot of things just jumbled up. So it was around that time that it kind of came out that she wasn't doing too well. And then a few years later, she still we're all still kind of close. My granddad died, and then it came out that she wasn't doing well. That's what it was. Sorry, just missed a bit of that timeline. Yeah, and then she was coming down drunk and crying and saying that she missed him and stuff like that. And that's when friction started. But then she got admitted to hospital, and it got scary because her liver was failing this time, and it wasn't just some prick that I didn't care about. So that was really scary. And then we kind of banded together to taking shifts. I think I was 14 at the time. We banded together to taking shifts to making sure she wasn't doing anything stupid, because she got told she was going to die when she went into the hospital. Then they told us probably not that week. And then suddenly it became, if anything happens over the next year, she mightn't last type thing, but she's still alive. So none of that actually happened. But when I stopped with my full, like, because me and her were really close. So I was going up every weekend and being there with her so that, not to stop her, I wasn't being there being like judging her and watching her to make sure she wasn't doing anything. But I think she just needed someone. She needed people with her. And we all realised that. She just needed someone because she didn't really have anybody then, because we'd all moved out and he died. So she just needed people there, and that kind of gave her enough that she didn't have to drink. But then one week I came up and she was definitely not sober. She was drunk and she tried to make excuses about, oh, it's really hard for her, this, that, that, blah, blah, blah. Load of stuff that I didn't care about. All I cared about was the fact that I was told she was going to die. Then she didn't die. But then I was told if she relapses, she'd die. And then she relapsed. So it wasn't that I hated her for being a shitty parent, because, you know, I didn't realise she was a shitty parent because I knew no different. I probably only realised that in the past few years. It was more that I didn't want to go through losing her. I didn't want to watch her die. So I got upset by that. And that's why I stopped kind of... That's why our relationship failed. I just didn't want to put up with this whole woman killing herself, basically. It was pointless. She knew what she was doing wrong, and I didn't want to go through the situation where we were in the hospital again. We were told she was going to die again, because I didn't want it to happen. So I just gave up and didn't care anymore. And I only really realised that was the reason in the past like year or two. I only realised that the reason I didn't want to talk to her at the time was because I was afraid of losing her. So I just cut off the relationship, and that's pretty much how the relationship ended. I don't know if I forgive her in the full forgiveness sense, but when my nanny was dying and she was up in the hospital with us and she was waiting, I got over the whole pettiness of, I'm not going to talk to you, I don't care if you live or die. I got over that whole thing, and I realised why. It was around then, well, it was before then that I realised why I'd cut off the relationship, the whole fear of her dying. And I'm not pushed by anymore, so I don't know if I've forgiven her. But I know I'm not so sour and sore about it anymore. I don't, like, I'm 21 now. It happened, 10 years ago? Like, it's over. Like, it's nothing I can change. And my aunt is always telling me that I should have a bubble, and whatever I can't change should be outside the bubble, and I shouldn't care about that stuff. And I'm kind of only getting that. She's been saying that to me since I was about 2. I've kind of only gotten that in the past 2 months. But yeah, there's nothing I can do now. It's over. There's no point in hating her for it. Because, again, she was an addict. Like, she relapsed into something that was extremely powerful. Like, it's hard to get over. And I'm not going to be pals with her, and we're not going to go out and get drinks together or meet up regularly or anything like that. But when I see her, I'm not the way I used to be. I'm not petty about it. I'm not hurtful towards her because she hurt me at some stage. I just talk to her and get it over with. I think she's kind of grown up in a way that I never thought she would. So I don't see why I should be immature towards her, because she wasn't really mature enough when she had kids to have kids. So, well, she'd probably never be mature enough to have kids. She probably still isn't mature enough to have kids. But she made mistakes, and there's no point in hating her for it. So I'm kind of over it.
What you're saying, like that you have matured too, or you've got a greater understanding as you get older of maybe some of the demons or the troubles that she had. Is that a right synopsis?
Yeah, when I was younger, I didn't really see the full picture. I just saw her from my point of view, and I never thought of her or that type of idea or how she was feeling about it. There was times when I did think about it, and I played on the fact that she'd be hurt by things I'd say to her, because we were very close. So if I tell her to fuck off and leave us alone, she'd get hurt by that, and I knew that. Mm-hmm. So I played on that at times, but I was too young to understand what I was doing.
Yeah.
That's why I'm thrown off, as I wasn't really. But yeah, I don't. It's not really that big of a deal anymore. It didn't really affect me at all. It never changed me. It never made me in any way. It did make sure that I would never do drugs in my life.
Who or what makes Glenn Glenn?
Janet may have done some bad things. She may have not done everything right. But again, she was very like Annie. She had bits of her like Annie. She cared for people and she was a very caring person, and we did get along very well. And she understands me still in a weird way that I'd never really get. And I do have bits of her in me. I tend to look like her a lot, which is not the greatest when people keep saying, oh, you're Janet's son. And it's like, oh, I wish I wasn't. But I can't change that either. So that happened. You can't choose your family. So yeah, I have bits of her in me. I have a big chunk of Anne, because Anne would be a very big part of my life, because she'd be the type that I'd look up to. I would have looked up to her from younger and still look up to, because she was very successful. She went to college, she got 2 degrees, she's Anne, she has a really good job, she has money. I don't have money. So I'd look up to Anne a lot, but Annie as well, from living with her, she'd changed me. Veronica, I have definitely got Veronica's temperament. A lot of people would, everybody kind of, I think I prove the theory that nurture is a lot stronger than nature, because I'd have a lot of Anne in me, because I'd look up to Anne and I'd be around Anne a lot, and Anne would have encouraged me to be weird. But then going through bullying, I started to kind of understand that not everybody has a perfect. And then I changed schools after 3rd year, and I went to St. Patrick's, and everybody was open and weird there, and I could be who I wanted to be. It was kind of like St. Trinian's in a way, like the school where all the weirdos went, and that's where I fitted in perfectly. There was like 1 or 2 normal people, and they were the freaks to us. So that would have contributed, because like it would have let me be me, which would have let me build up a lot of me. Then belong to would have played a huge part in me becoming who I am, because I was in belong to from the age of 14 until now. Well, not so much lately, I don't really go all that often, but I just belong to, like, it was huge, because I...
What did they do for you, and, you know, who are they?
Oh, yeah, belong to. Belong to is an LGBT group for young LGBT teenagers, people from the age of 14 to 24, so I can still go, even though I'm old. And all the rest of them are like 14 to 16. They're just so old over here. But they kind of I don't know what the word is. They basically set it in stone that being gay was okay, and I could really be whatever I wanted, and nobody could judge me for that, because, as some people say, only God can judge me. I don't care what God says either. Only I can judge. And throughout the years, like, belong to organised makeup workshops, which became drag workshops for me, with Veda, one of Dublin's bigger queens. And that's the first time I got to do drag. And then that following Pride, I did drag, and I've been to 7 Prides. So and walking in the parade with belong to would always be huge, because that sense of community. And I learned a lot in belong to, like different things about gender and sexuality that shaped what I would be. And they gave me a lot of confidence, because they encouraged us to become facilitators, which then we run the groups on a Sunday, and we'd do training and stuff in the background. And that gave me confidence. And then Belong To just like blew that up. Between Belong To and St. Patrick's, I kind of shaped who I was myself. After getting a whole lot of nurture from my family, they would have built up me. And then I became this.
So you've been a drag queen, or are you still a drag queen?
Oh God, drag queen Glenn, or should I say Bo?
So what was your drag queen name?
Well, my drag name is Bo Peekaboo, and that started along with my drag career in Belong To that lovely sunny Sunday. It was gorgeous out, actually. We did a photo shoot with Veda, and it was kind of to finish off the makeup workshops we'd been doing, learning bits about makeup. She and her makeup crew of people helped us get into costume, and we did a photo shoot then. And I did Little Bo Peep, because I completely adored Little Bo Peep out of Toy Story. Remember the big dress and her little sheep, and she got Woody by the neck with her crook. And it was just brilliant. So and we were doing a kind of weird team as Belong To that year. I think it was Stories or something like that. And I wanted to do that, so I said I'd do it for the photo shoot and then just repeat it. Little did I know, repeating makeup isn't as easy as it looks. So I did that. It was fun. It was the week before Pride as well, so Veda dragged us up. And I blame her on my addiction to plucking my eyebrows, because she got me sent off to get my eyebrows done and everything so that I'd look amazing. And she still calls me one of her drag babies. So she's still my drag mother, and I can still go back to Veda if, like a few weeks ago, I went back to Veda to perform because I'd missed her so much. And she was perfectly helpful in getting me back onto that stage. And after that, it kind of just took off. I just got obsessed with it. I was probably always obsessed with like makeup and performing and dressing up as a woman, because I used to do this as a child. I used to put on like big t-shirts or nightdresses and stick a t-shirt onto my head and get up onto the sofa and dance. And I don't know, I think I was always a drag queen. But then after that, the week after that, actually, the night before Pride, I came out to Anne and Sean, and then my family. So drag kind of pushed me out of that closet a bit. I kind of just, yeah, I'll go with this. And then every Pride I was doing drag after that, and Halloween and stuff like that. But then what got me performing, because I still hadn't performed, was when I was 18. I was almost 19 at the time. I did a competition called the Ringmasters Drag Race in the Dragon Bar. And I lost. Okay, I came fourth. But it was crazy getting up onto the stage and actually performing for once and trying to make up. And I had a while of practice with the makeup, but still, I was nowhere near good. It was shocking. I look back at the pictures and I just think, why did I bother? But I got up and I did. My first performance was Lady Gaga Dancing in the Dark. And I got up in this dress that I'd made, and it was all snap fastened together. And I got up onto the stage and I pulled each bit of it off as the performance went through. And I did it kind of based on this whole domestic abuse type situation. I don't know. It was a bit of an odd too much in the one performance. I started off dead with my throat slit, and then went from this 1950s housewife to PVC goddess. And there was blood everywhere. And that was kind of the style I went for at first. And I've kind of shied from that, because in Dublin, the gay scene don't really want me to cover them in blood. I don't know why. I like them. But yeah, I came forth in that. I didn't win. Whatever. Shabbins. Then the next year, I decided I'd go for it again. But this time, I decided I was going to win. And I did. I managed to win it, which came with two contracts and other prizes involving money and something else. There was something else. A crown. Oh, I broke that. Veda technically made me. She's the one who first dragged me up. She's the one who first introduced me to drag, and that's why I would call her my drag mother. She was the one who made me, and she'd still call herself my drag mother. So I really like that. That makes me happy to hear Veda say that I'm hers. She created me. But yeah, she made me. She gave me my first drag self. And after that, I think she created a monster, but she seems proud.
Are your drag days over?
I don't know. I'm not sure about the Dublin scene and whether they like me, because I'm not really your average drag queen. I like to be that little bit different and I like to do different performances, but the Dublin scene seemed, well, not so much based in Veda, because they're really good at kind of that alternative, because Veda's quite alternative and she likes to do Kate Bush and those type of, she does odd performances, whereas in The Dragon it was more pop and you had to kind of do a performance that the audience could dance along to, and that changed me a bit and broke me, and I started to do performances that didn't really suit my character. So that's why I kind of got pushed from it, and now I'm just lazy. But as proven by when I contacted her, she let me go onto the show straight away and encouraged me to, and I will definitely go back soon.
Do you believe in God?
I don't know if I believe in God per se. I'm more of a pagan type based beliefs. I'm more nature, Mother Nature, that type of vibe. So I don't know about God. I'm presuming there's something. I believe there is probably something, but I don't know what. And I do believe in like Mother Nature and that kind of, the earth is a lot stronger than we thought it was. And when it comes to a God in the holiness of Christianity and the whole, you pray to him and he'll purify it and he'll be there to help you and all that, it does make me wonder why, after my mother had done so much wrong, she was allowed a second chance. But after my nanny had done so much good, she kept getting things. Like, she got the arthritis, which was pain, and then she got the lung condition, which almost killed her the first time around, and then she got cancer, which then eventually swallowed her whole. So, but she kind of got that moment of, yay, I'm free, like, after the surgery, and she's doing the chemo, yay, everything's perfect. No, actually, you're done. Like, people say those moments make them question God. I was questioning them way longer before that, so I don't know.
You were born in the year that homosexuality in Ireland was decriminalised. What are your thoughts on the marriage equality referendum?
When I realised I was gay and came out to myself, I was told I couldn't be married a lot. I was told I couldn't have kids. I was told things that I couldn't do for a long time. And it made me realise that that's not fair, because I'm as gay as Christmas and I've been planning my big white wedding since like I was really small. I've been thinking about that. That's the type of thing us girls think about. But I was thinking about it today, and I was thinking about how I've always wanted to be married. Probably not married. I don't know. Like, I've always wanted to be happy, and I've thought about marriage and I've thought about the big wedding and I've thought about where I've had it. I wrote an essay for Skill once about the marriage equality coming in and what my wedding would be like, and this whole detailed array of my wedding, and I've planned it out and I've decided that I want a wedding and it's going to happen. Whether I have to kill someone for it or not. I'd be bridezilla, like I'd be full on crazy type, that type of person. And at this moment in time, I can't be that type of person, not in Ireland anyway. And if you're going to get married somewhere, like, you're going to get married at home. And if you do get married somewhere else, like, a lot of people go to Spain and go to different parts of the world to get married in a nice hot place. I don't know why wedding dresses weigh a ton. But I wanted to be recognised at home. So what I would say to people for voting on marriage equality, I'd tell them to not think of it as two gay men getting married or two gay women getting married. Think of it as everybody deserves to be able to imagine their big white wedding. Or, well, probably not white. I'm definitely not having a white wedding. I don't know about most people today having a white wedding. But everybody should be able to grow up thinking about that wedding. And a lot of the problems with parents when they find out their kids are LGBT is they lose a lot. Like, you tell a boy comes out to his mother as gay and she loses the wedding day, she loses the grandkids, the dad loses his name being carried on, you know, the whole masculinity vibe. And that's, that plays a big part in, they don't know what to expect for their child's future, and the child doesn't know what to expect for their future as well. Like, once you discover you're gay, at this moment in time in this country, you discover you can't have a lot of things. You can pretty much be you and that's it. And that's all well and good, but I don't want my wedding day to be taken from me. And I don't want, if my grandmother was alive, I know she wouldn't want to miss that. And I know Anne doesn't want to miss my wedding day. And it's something that I have no choice in, and no gay child has a choice in right now. And they can't look forward to their wedding day, and parents of gay kids can't look forward to giving away their kids or seeing their child on their big day. Like, a mother of a daughter always thinks of their wedding day. They'll always think of it. It's a natural thing. And if that daughter is a lesbian, their wedding day is gone, in this country at least. And I think people should vote yes just to give people the opportunity. If you choose not to get married, you choose not to get married. No, someone has chosen for you not to get married. I think you should just give people that little dream.
What would your advice be to a young gay person today?
I tell them they are what they are and there's nothing wrong with that. That's pretty much all you can tell someone that feels they're different in any way, because I was different my whole life. I've always been that little bit odd. So if someone would have told me, like Anne did on many occasions, I mean, Annie called me the queer one, not because I was gay, but because I was a weirdo. Language around this area was different when she was younger. But it's okay to be different. I hope one day people won't have the realization that they may like the same sex, and for that to be a negative thing in their head, because it was negative for me, but I didn't know why at the time. And it's negative for so many people. The moment they realize who they are, they straight away think there's something wrong with this. And one day, hopefully, that won't be a problem. But again, as long as gay people have to come out, they'll feel like there's something wrong with them. So I just tell them that they are what they are, and they have to live with that. No, they have to live with that, because that sounds really horrible. No, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with being different.
Glenn, what would you like to see in the future?
Oh, I don't know. I'd hope that one day I would get back into fashion, and instead of just trying to get money, which I'm doing at the moment, I hope to have furthered that side of my career and explored it a lot more and gotten somewhere with it, like have my own label or be working for a big label and have money. I know saying that I want money in my future is kind of terrible, but I want to be comfortable. I want to have a career that I like, first of all, so fashion, which I do love. I want to be like a designer, but I want to have, like, be successful at it so that I'm comfortable, not anything else. And I don't know, what would I like to see in future, Glenn? Happy. Comfortable is one thing, but if you're not happy with it, it's boring. So happy.
Happy. Many thanks to Glenn for sharing his story and being so open, honest and sincere in his answers. Not always easy in your early 20s, and something that I certainly couldn't have done. I'm confident of his dream of being happy is one that he'll succeed in, whatever his future holds. You can join the conversation over on Facebook, facebook.com/MichaelMeets, facebook.com/MichaelMeets, or for those of you on Twitter, you can follow me @Michael_Conlon, or follow the podcast @MichaelMeets. Do you know someone I should meet? If so, drop me an email, hello@MichaelMeets.com. This week's podcast is supported by Jared O'Donnell Photography. You can check out some amazing work on his website, www.jaredodonnell.ie, jaredodonnell.ie, or on Facebook, facebook.com/JaredO'Donnell Photography, facebook.com/JaredO'Donnell Photography. He has some great scenic pictures of Ireland and some fantastic portraits of its citizens. Michael Meets is available on iTunes, Audioboom, SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Podbeam, or wherever you get your podcast by searching Michael Meets. Many thanks for all your encouraging messages, comments and tweets, and the hundreds of you who have downloaded this podcast each week. And thank you for your patience this past fortnight while I was on vacation.